Well, look, I think the reason to talk about the Chilean Revolution is not just because it's so inspiring, which I hope I'll, kind of paint a bit of a picture of, but it's because it has so many lessons for socialists to learn today. And unfortunately, lots of people have drawn the wrong lessons from the history of Chile. For starters, a very common refrain that the workers went too far. And this is what the Socialist Party were concerned about from the very beginning of the revolution. If only the workers hadn't taken their struggle too far, confronted the right wing in Chilean politics, bloodshed could have been avoided and things could have ended more peacefully. If you read articles in Jacobin, written by moderate socialists today, you'll find they're of the opinion that an immediate transition to socialism was never on the cards in Chile. And they believe you could only get so far in terms of economic and social progress under one president. So basically, this is just kicking the can down the road, making excuses, I think, for why socialism needs to be won through a long, drawn-out, and gradual process. Some even write about how the Popular Unity government was faced with an unwinnable civil war. And both of these arguments do the same thing. They absolve UP of a responsibility to fight for real socialism. All of the excuses argue the same thing. Chile proves the only path to socialism is through the parliamentary road. And this is just not true. In Chile during the 70s, it's the clearest example that there was not a parliamentary road to socialism. The bloody coup and brutal dictatorship that was set up was a consequence of the failure of the revolution to fully break with the parliamentary road and embrace a more radical view of what socialism has to be. The socialists in parliament in Chile didn't agree with that argument because they were reformists. And this is what I'll be spending the bulk of my talk going through. What kind of politics did the reformist socialists have? What was their approach to parliament and the capitalist state? And why reformist politics are the reason that the revolution didn't succeed? And I'll be going through the most important events of the revolution to kind of prove each of those things. And it's important to note before I start that the revolution was not unsuccessful for a lack of trying. From 1970 to 73, the working class rose up against capitalism and wanted to fight for socialism. They fought their bosses, they fought the growing fascist presence in the streets, and they even wanted to fight the eventual coup that was launched by the army. And instead, the limits of the revolution were not placed by them, but by the Popular Unity Coalition headed by Salvador Allende. So, how did UP, Popular Unity, I'm just going to call them UP for the talk, how did they and Allende come to power? Well, in the years before Allende was elected, the class struggle was already heating up in Chile. Under the previous president, Eduardo Frei, there'd been an enormous general strike in 1967 to push back on proposed limits on the right to strike. And the success of this strike gave the working class a huge boost in confidence. It basically cemented the politics that you have to fight for what you want under capitalism if workers are going to get what they deserve. And during this rising militancy from workers, there was also a rise in student protests and the setting up of student revolutionary groups like the MIR, which is the Movement of the Revolutionary Left. Throughout Frei's rule, he also tried to implement moderate land reforms. It's basically a measure he thought could help maybe buy off sections of the peasantry and workers and basically cool their militancy. But it had a totally opposite effect. It only further encouraged workers to begin land occupations and squatting. So basically, workers just started taking the land as their own. They didn't need permission. They didn't want permission to do it. So Frei, who was in the right-wing and pro-capitalist Christian Democrats Party, was kicked out and replaced by Allende. And Allende was elected to president as a member of the Socialist Party. But the Socialist Party could only win if they ran in a coalition with other parties. And this coalition is called Popular Unity. It was a grouping of like six other political parties, but I'm basically just going to focus on the Socialist Party for this talk. Popular unity is often described in a much more radical way than I think it actually should be. I think you can characterize it as a center-left coalition whose goal was to pursue the electoral road to socialism. So, what is the electoral road to socialism? We'll take it from Allende himself, who said in January of 1971 that the situation in Chile is such that the constitution can be changed within the constitution by a means of plebiscites. Some inspiring stuff, The electoral road to socialism basically means fighting for a society of socialism entirely within the means of the capitalist framework through its institutions and without overthrowing them. It involves winning a series of elections to try and carry out that gradual process. And there's a few key reasons why UP supported the electoral or the constitutional path to socialism. First of all, they believed it was necessary and strategically correct to make cross-class alliances. Their vision of socialism was one where you gradually reform the economy to being state-run, not necessarily worker-run. And this obviously made them butt heads with the private capitalists who are greedy and want to hoard all of their wealth to themselves. To overcome this roadblock, Popular Unity actually made overtures to the wealthy and constantly sought approval and collaboration from the non-Marxist middle classes, assuring them that a UP victory would only hurt the monopolists and imperialists. So it just means the most rich, you know, Chilean capitalists in America. And Allende would often actually repress strikers and protesters to show the rich that he didn't want things to get too out of hand. The other reason they supported this pathway is because they believed the capitalist state was an institution that, if captured by socialists, can represent working class interests. When socialists want to achieve immense social change through the state, however, they're confronted with the fact that the state does not work for all people. That's why the law, the courts, cops, and military all actually exist. They exist to defend the ruling class. They exist to defend the capitalist class and create rules for workers to live under and protect the wealth and power of the 1%. Allende thought all of these institutions would support a left-wing parliament's effort to gradually nationalise industry and improve workers' pay and conditions. But these institutions proved that they were totally opposed to these goals. Socialism cannot be won by seeking compromise or middle ground with forces who want to defend capitalism. And so for the rest of the talk, I want to raise three crucial moments that show the limits of this reformism in action. The first is the signing of the Statute of Guarantees. The second is the lorry strike and the creation of the cordones. And the third is Super's coup and the Pinochet coup. And in each of these moments, the Socialist Party showed that they feared the working class independently asserting their class power. They believed this independent assertion of workers' power could jeopardise the parliamentary road to socialism. So, first of all, let's talk about the Statute of Guarantees. Since the Socialist Party didn't win an absolute majority in the 1970 election, both houses of parliament had to decide on the presidential winner. So before the revolution has even kicked off properly, there was a major problem. The UP coalition had to convince other right-wing parties in parliament, like the Christian Democrats I mentioned earlier, to vote for Allende to become president. Imagine that. A socialist gets elected to run the country and they're basically from the very get-go held to ransom by conservatives. This is one of the limitations of working towards a socialist society within the constitution. So anyway, in exchange for voting for Allende, the Christian Democrats say, yeah, sure, we'll do it in exchange for a set of guarantees. And this is what the Statute of Guarantees is. It's a set of promises made by Allende to pro-capitalist forces and sections of the state that he would leave whole swathes of capitalism untouched. Three specific promises were made. So the first, continued existence of individual freedoms under the current political system. So did this mean we should, you know, protect the civil and democratic rights of workers? No, that's actually not what he was talking about. It was a promise to the capitalists, the middle class, and groups with serious power like the military and also the media that nobody from Popular Unity wanted to step on their toes. He wanted these groups to continue to have the freedom to exploit people with limited regulation. And that's a pretty serious conciliation for a socialist to make very early on. Socialism cannot be made by creating friends with individuals who benefit from profit making. Okay, the second promise, the legal system, it should stay. This should be obvious to anti-capitalists today that the law is not genuinely about ensuring people's safety, nor is it a reflection of what's morally good or bad in society. The law upholds the capitalist system. Courts and judges make decisions to empower the rich and punish the poor. And the court system in Chile continued to do this while the revolution was happening. In fact, Allende would often call on workers to respect law and order when they were nationalising their factories without the permission of the government, and even when they fought the fascists in the streets.
The reformists in Chile used the law against the most radical sections of the working class, much to the left of Allende, who were desperately trying to build grassroots socialism from the factories. One of the most heinous examples of this is the creation of the Arms Control Law in 1973. What was that? It was a law where the Chilean state basically gave themselves powers to raid the factories and confiscate the arms that workers had to defend themselves from the fascist military and fascist organizations. That's the kind of law they wanted to keep around. And the third promise, the armed forces and police should continue to exist to guarantee democracy. I think this is the craziest of them all. The army does not exist to protect the working class, and it doesn't exist to protect democracy. Capitalist armies are hostile to real workers' democracy, where a majority of workers get to have a say in how we run production and society. This is because they are defenders of capitalist nation states. And they are undemocratic and exploitative. Its upper ranks of generals are the most vicious and violent defenders of the capitalist system. In revolutions, the lower ranks of the army may be won away from their generals. And this is because we have an understanding that even the army has class divisions in it. Like a workplace, there are those who give orders and those who take orders. However, this process of the army splitting is not some automatic thing that will just happen, and it did not happen in the Chilean Revolution. If the lower ranks of the army are not broken from their generals, they can and will use the entire armed forces to restore capitalism and crush the working class. And so anyway, in summary, I think before things even kicked off, Allende makes promises to forces to the right of him that he does not want to touch the power of the capitalist state. Earlier, I'd said that socialists can be held to ransom by conservatives if they work within the state. But I also just want to take a moment to make it very, very clear that the UP coalition did not sign this statute against their will. It was well within their reformist framework that this is something that has to be embarked on at the beginning of mass social change. Allende agreed with the strategy of creating alliances with pro-capitalist forces and believed that pro-capitalist institutions may well have to continue to exist. And it's necessary if you think that socialism is won gradually by winning greater votes in parliament and then using your position in the government to change the economy against the will of the 1%. The other terrible thing about the Statute of Guarantees, I think it says a lot about the statute, but this set of promises to the rich was never proposed to rank and file members of the Popular Unity Coalition and the Socialist Party. It was kept behind closed doors, and this is another unfortunate feature of reformist politics, an elitism where they don't trust masses of workers to have a say in politics, either for fear of criticism or fear of workers pushing things in a much more left-wing direction. So, I want to get into some of the moments in the revolution now. And the most crucial moment of the entire revolution to go through is the lorry strike. So very few confrontations happened in the first half of 1971 between workers and the Popular Unity government, because workers believed this was their government. And it was fighting for true socialism. And for a period of time, the government successfully raised wages, reduced unemployment, and carried out nationalizations. By 1972, just to get a picture of how, advanced what was happening in Chilean society was, Chile had nationalized most of the monopoly companies, mines, national and foreign banks, and seized 6 million hectares of arable land. But the thing to remember is that the workers were often a very, driving force behind all of this and were seizing factories at a rate faster than what the government wanted. Workers were pushing things further forward. And this dynamic of workers fighting upset the capitalists, the big multinationals, landowners, and the right wing of parliament. And so by October of 1972, the capitalist class, they said, "I'm sick of this, I've had enough." They were sick of the workers demanding more, and those right-wing parties encouraged the bosses in transport and logistics industries to have a capital strike of their own. This meant that they essentially locked workers out of their workplaces by taking their trucks away from the worksite. So that's like the picture of what that looks like. You know, bosses literally taking away the means that workers have, not just to, organize production and go to work and carry out the work that you do every day, but also it stopped them from getting to work as well. And they did this so that workers could not do their jobs effectively where they have power in production. And this was an attempt to try and sow total economic chaos. their goal to accelerate the fall of the UP government for the next election. They wanted all classes, capitalists, middle classes, workers, and professionals to turn against Allende in the moment of crisis that they'd created. So the effects of the bosses' strike went beyond transporting and distributing goods as well. Like I said, public transport across Santiago was almost non-existent. 70% of the private bus services in Santiago were totally gotten rid of during the bosses' strike. And professionals in the communications sector also refused to go to work, which further sent production and just like civil society into chaos. Now, if you've watched the documentary, The Battle of Chile, I think this is one of my favorite like left-wing documentaries I've ever watched in my life, if you have like over 3 hours to spare. You'll see workers refer to those who participated in the capital strike as the mummies. This is a derogatory term that they came up with for all of the out-of-touch conservative opponents of the UP government who tried to sabotage their rule. But the mummies were never just attacking Allende. It's important to remember this. They were attacking the entire class of people whose labor made the country run. It's safe to say that the mummies, through this act of a capital strike, had made a lot of enemies because workers didn't sit around and just like wait while the bosses tried to sabotage them. The working class responded quickly. What did they do? First, workers commandeered the bosses' vehicles or found transport back to the factories. At their factories and workplaces, mass meetings of workers assembled to discuss how should workers fight back? What do we have to do to take control over production, distribution, and transport? Not just for ourselves, but for the Chileans that the bosses were now deliberately trying to starve as a punishment. As far as some workers were concerned, what they were doing was just trying to carry on as usual. But I think what they were doing was anything but usual. In restarting production, workers had established one of the most democratic bodies of working class power, and this was the cordones. So the cordones, it translates to industrial belts. They were rank and file organizations of workers in an industrial district. And their purpose was to organize and run production by workers and for workers. They also could further develop into a popular assembly with a popular militia. Now, this was not the first time that the cordones were set up in October of 1972. Only a few months earlier in the summer, agricultural workers in Maipú tried to carry on with more land expropriations for farming. This was something that Allende, you know, got up and said he was supposedly for. But their efforts were repeatedly blocked by local courts and judges. And these workers received no support for their efforts from the Allende government because they were moving too far ahead of the UP program. Dozens of workers were arrested when they went to the streets to protest this. They were arrested by the same police that Allende said are meant to guarantee democracy. And after they took to the streets, they basically said that we want no more bourgeois class justice, we want working class justice. Now, I think this is an important moment. It shows the contradiction of Allende's election victory, which people are probably starting to pick up on now. Allende and the Socialist Party and the Popular Unity Coalition being in power opened the space for more radical struggles where workers put into practice what the UP just talked about. But in the process, they went beyond what UP, the reformist coalition, was actually willing to do. So in the neighbouring industrial area of Surillo, workers had a mass march to support the farm workers and demanded that they want no more capitalist democracy. We should essentially set up workers' organisations. And to make this happen, again, this is like the very first cordon set up months before this moment. They set up the Cordon Surillo Maipú to bring together workers from all around the factories in that district. They also created a political program that was way more radical than anything that had been proposed by the Socialist Party so far. Now, the first cordon was born out of a struggle for power between the old ruling class and the working class. This individual cordon was powerful, but it was only a singular one. By the time of October, again, like we were just talking about, the cordones had massively expanded. The cordones went from existing in one neighbourhood to 31 across the country. So what did the cordones do in October? What did they do during the lorry strike instead? Again, they provided room for political discussion and debate among workers on questions about the revolution. And this kind of working class democracy is going to be essential if we actually want workers to be in the driver's seat of production and society, if we want workers to run the world. Workers organised also to take groceries and other products to people's neighbourhoods where there were food shortages, which were caused by the wealthy trying to hoard everything during this moment of crisis. The cordoners also set up vigilance committees. These were units of armed workers who enjoyed their bosses being gone and they wanted to keep them away for as long as possible. And in that documentary, The Battle of Chile, there's a very funny moment where a worker actually proposes to other people, I think we should build a watchtower outside, you know, our factory. We should build a watchtower so that we can like literally see them coming if they try and attack us. And the rest of the workers are like, we don't have the time to do that. Like, that sounds very nice, but we should probably focus on like our political organizing. And the existence of the cordoners also gave workers in much smaller factories, shops, workplaces throughout the rest of the city to have the power to confront their bosses. And this is because workers organised in the cordoners could extend meaningful solidarity to the rest of the working class and the oppressed, who previously may not have been as organised as some of the others were. So by the time the cordoners had taken control of production, the narrative from the bosses about total chaos, it ceased to make any sense anymore. And that's because things were running more smoothly under workers' control than bosses' control. And so the bosses' strike ended on the 10th of November, and it did not end with the outcome that they had hoped for. Huge swathes of professionals in the city who had started on the side of the bosses moved to the side of the workers because everything was running better under workers' control. And to the bosses' disgust, which is what they were trying to prevent in the first place, actually, workers had come out more organised, more radical, and more powerful than they were before. Now, here is where I want to introduce the role that the reformists in Parliament played during this period, because all of this is based off the self-initiative and self-activity of workers. And in what was one of the most inspiring and powerful acts of workers fighting back against capitalism, Allende and the Popular Unity Coalition acted against these workers, exercising their power. So at first, the Communist parties and the Communist and Socialist parties, both part of the UP coalition, boycotted the cordoners, saying that they threatened the major trade union federation and that workers should just shut them down in our wake of that. Eventually, the only positive thing Allende would come to say about the cordoners was that they saved the government, which is pretty interesting. Saved his own skin, but he still thinks they shouldn't exist. And, you know, that's really important because the lesson the workers had actually, you know, learned was that the only way we can defeat the bosses and even have brought that situation about in the first place is if we out-organise the bosses collectively. Once the cordoners had been sidelined by Allende, he promised to return private property to the owners of the factories, the workers who had just taken the workplaces for themselves. He said they should be returned. And in the middle of the bosses' strike, another very important thing happened. This is when Allende organised or reorganised his parliamentary cabinet to include military generals to help restore order in the middle of a mass crisis in which workers were making a move to take power. A campaign ensued for social peace, which meant using the military to force workers to go back to work under their bosses. And this decision was widely discussed and debated among the working class. Many of them actually were incredibly outraged that the generals should even be allowed to have influence in what they considered their government. To push back on this kind of conservatism from Allende, workers would have needed to be independently organised from the Popular Unity Coalition and, you know, to combat their restrictive politics and what they took, which was a disciplinary attitude to workers' self-activity. For the most part, workers believed that the cordoners were the way forward, but they still thought that the cordoners' role was to put pressure on the UP government to carry out their demands. But Allende and Popular Unity had proven multiple times that they had no interest in full-scale workers' power over politics and the economy. I think it's worth taking a moment to think about this was a very similar situation to what happened in the 1917 Russian Revolution, or kind of the moment we're in. The Soviets existed after the overthrow of the Tsar, but so did a provisional government. And the working class could only take power when a majority of workers were convinced that the provisional government And like loser parties that supported them, like the Mensheviks, did not reflect working class interests, and they had to be overpowered. That's the only way that workers can take power. A similar situation in Chile. Though the cordones were not as, it's important to, say, they were not as developed or widespread as the Soviets in Russia, the point to take away is that they were an embryonic form of workers' power. They could have been expanded, and they could have replaced the need for a capitalist parliament at all. It was a situation where the old ruling class and the cordones were in a battle with one another, and it was an opportunity to build real workers' power, but it was again lost to Allende, the reformist parties, and the parliamentary road to socialism. But the revolution doesn't end here. Obviously, even though the strike was wrapped up, it did not mean that like there was just full-scale like social peace. In fact, there was still an atmosphere of total like class war, which only further exacerbated more crisis. And this is what led to Super's coup. Now, this one might sound a little bit unfamiliar to people, but it's the coup attempt that happened before the Pinochet coup. And it was an attempt by a minority in the army, and they were unsuccessful at this attempt. But this was a warning shot to the working class and the UP that the right and the military wanted to crush the class struggle, and they wanted to crush every single person involved in it. Workers flooded out to the streets, and Allende addressed a mass crowd of workers on the night that the coup was put down. But the immediate question that was on everyone's minds that this raised: should the working class be armed to defend themselves if this ever happened again? And huge numbers of workers and peasants believed, yes, we should be armed. And they called on Allende to arm them. There's video footage of mass rallies where workers marched through the streets calling, "We want a popular militia." And the UP ignored all of this. Both the socialist and the Communist Party leaders went as far to denounce the workers for calling, who were calling for arms as ultra-leftists. It's absolutely shameful. And Popular Unity explicitly believed that the working class should not be armed. Their reasoning, that they wanted to avoid a civil war. But all revolutions must eventually make a decisive confrontation with the capitalist class. This is what an insurrection is. When there's a dual power situation, one side must come out on top. Arming the working class is one of the many things necessary to make sure workers can defend their gains, win in revolutions, and so on. But even when the working class are armed, they still need a clear political objective and must be decisively for overthrowing the state and taking power themselves. Weapons are important, though. They tie the balance and help workers defend themselves. Now, the Socialist Party had a very, very different approach. Instead of calling on workers to arm themselves or helping workers to arm themselves, they thought that we could use the parliament to prevent any future coup attempts. Again, very inspiring stuff. Allende went into parliament with a bill that would give him special powers to dismiss people in the military, and he said, "I will use these powers to sack all of the people who have orchestrated Super's coup." The first problem is obvious. This can only be done after a coup attempt. Like, it's a bit, late to try and like fight military generals after. The second problem was that Allende overestimated how much support this bill would receive in the parliament. He lost the vote because he received no support from the right-wing parties. And actually, people in the UP coalition voted against this bill. Other people did not even think we had to sack the generals from the cabinet. So there were serious limits on Allende's strategy of looking to the right of you for left-wing support. The parliamentary strategy of fighting the right led to a dead end, and Popular Unity was stubborn and refused to let the working class be armed to independently defend themselves. And this is how the stage was set for the final attack on the Chilean working class. 4 months, there had been a debate in the Chilean ruling class and among Chilean, members of the Chilean state, how to take down the UP government. And there were two camps. First, there were those who wanted to respect legality, and they thought, we should just oust Allende through an election. But when Popular Unity's vote actually grew at the beginning of 1973, more people moved into the second camp, who believed it was necessary to overthrow the government and crush one of the most radical working classes in the world. Articles were openly published in newspapers calling for the overthrow of Allende. I found one of the titles of one of these articles. It's called "Eight Measures to Depose the Government." This is what was printed in the newspapers every single day, this kind of stuff. And for months, this went on and on and on. But again, not all hope was lost. Just days before the coup and in the midst of a crisis, Allende's supporters organized one of the biggest rallies ever in the country's history. Workers marched all day and night. They chanted, "Allende, Allende, the people will defend you. The expropriated factories will never be handed back. The time for conciliation is over. It's time to fight." This is a pretty good poll of what workers thought and, I think the drive that they had to basically try and fight the right. But the working class at this point was still unarmed and underorganized around the country to resist a coup. And in response to these enormous demonstrations, what did Allende say? Can anyone take a guess? He said, "I want to organize another plebiscite to resolve the crisis in a democratic and constitutional way." Now, this plebiscite had a chosen date. It was the 11th of September. And this was the day that eventually on September 11, General Augusto Pinochet, who was, in the UP cabinet, he was invited in by Allende, led a decisive campaign of terror against workers and popular unity. The military bombed Santiago City, targeting the presidential palace, and murdered Allende. Military generals either suspended or took control of all of the democratic institutions that had existed. And so the longest representative democracy in Latin American history ceased to exist. Workers were rounded up into sports stadiums, which effectively became concentration camps where leaders of the workers' and socialist movement were slaughtered. Trade unions and working class parties were made illegal. And under the new Pinochet dictatorship, Chile became the first country to implement what we know as neoliberalism. And it's always said by reformists that the parliamentary road to socialism must be taken to avoid bloodshed. That's a load of crap. It was the limitations of the reformist politics that were directly responsible for the Pinochet coup, nothing else. It's an important lesson for revolutionary socialists to learn in liberal democratic countries like America, Britain, and Australia today that there's nothing worth saving about the capitalist state. It's a totally thoroughly disgusting series of institutions that needs a political alternative so that we can combat the politics of slow, gradual reform through the state. So, I don't really want to end on that note. I want to talk a little bit more about what are some other important things in any revolution, what is happening in the revolutionary left. So, if the UP coalition did not have the politics to win socialism in Chile, well, who did? It's a really hard question to answer because essentially no group had all the correct answers or all the correct politics. The two main left groups that are often floated are the MIR and the Socialist Party Left. So the MIR was a Marxist student group, who'd broken away from the Socialist Party. They idolized like Che Guevara, the Cuban Revolution, and this explains why they oriented to the working class quite late in the game. Before this, they mostly organized around the Chilean peasantry before eventually kind of orienting more to workers, but again, they didn't really have a concept of workers' power. Instead, it was all about the people, the urban poor, and the popular neighborhood committees instead of the industrial ones. Then there was a left-wing faction inside the Socialist Party who did have criticisms of Allende, but always continued to tolerate him. They believed that forms of popular power, like the cordones, could coexist with the project of achieving socialism through parliamentary reform. There were plenty of rank-and-file members of the left wing of the Socialist Party who were extremely radical, open to revolutionary politics, and much to the left of Allende. That's lots of people who were like the types of people who led the cordones. So, for example, this guy, Armando Cruces, who was the leader of one of the cordones. And people like him, other people like him, wavered between Allende's reformist parliamentary path to socialism and something more radical. So there was clearly an audience of people for what could have formed the basis for what was really needed, a revolutionary party. Overall, both the MIR and the Socialist Party left faction had the same problems in common. Both could acknowledge popular unity's failure to lead the working class and deepen the revolution, but they drew the conclusion that the UP should just reform themselves in the light of like their critique. both also did not have an understanding that socialist revolution is only possible on the basis of independent workers' self-activity. And this is why everyone was so uneasy about the cordones and the power that they had. The far left shared the fears of popular unity about workers running too far ahead of their elected government and jeopardizing everything. And finally, this is not just a thing of the far left. This is a thing of any organization that called itself on the left at the time. All organized left forces in Chile did not object to the military entering the cabinet on Allende's invitation. Now, without a revolutionary party with experience in the class struggle and the politics to take the revolution forward, those problems were going to be extremely hard to solve. So I want to wrap up. I think the reason, again, just to say it, the reason to talk about the Chilean revolution is because it's a real life example of a debate that people have probably gotten a sense of throughout this, you know, conference. It's a reform versus revolution debate that has been happening since the beginning of the socialist movement. And this debate is not just something about like left-wing theory or something in the hypothetical. It matters for whether revolutions, which we know are bound to break out in capitalism, it matters for whether they're going to succeed or not. And so when the revolution unfolded in Chile, a basic pattern happened over and over again. The right were uncompromising defenders of capitalism, and the working class kept struggling to defend their gains and introduce workers' power. And Allende, caught between a rock and a hard place in all of this, had faith in the constitutional order. Allende always argued that no sensible revolutionary can ignore the state. And revolutionaries shouldn't ignore it. They should aim to smash it entirely. The whole thing has to go. It's not an institution that can be captured and used as a vehicle to introduce socialism, like Popular Unity argued. This strategy can only lead to a series of sellouts and class collaboration. And so I think to do the memory of the Chilean revolution justice, we need to take the right lessons away. We cannot win socialism from above. We can only win socialism from below. It has to come from the creative initiative of workers, and it cannot be prevented or held back by politicians or the capitalist state. And if reformist politicians try to hold workers back, workers should fight them as well.